Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. An estimated 3 million people have fled brutal violence in El Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras. 10% of the population in those countries have fled, mostly to the United States. Since 2014, U.S. authorities have apprehended about 100,000 unaccompanied minors fleeing gang recruitment, physical and sexual violence, and poverty. Behind those numbers are individual stories that paint a vivid and horrific picture of the realities that drive millions to flee their homes, and so many do this alone. The New American Story Project is documenting the stories of children fleeing violence. 17-year-old Maria left Guatemala for the U.S. after being repeatedly harassed by a man who eventually raped her when she was 14. 17-year-old Tomas left Guatemala after continuous assaults and threats on his life for refusing to sell drugs. 16-year-old Jose left Honduras after repeated death threats and assaults for being gay. As he made the journey north, smugglers told him that if he didn't pay more money, they would cut off his head and bury him alive. Joining us today to talk about these devastating stories are two guests. Micheline Marcombe is founder and creative director of the New American Story Project. She's professor of creative writing at Mills College and Goddard College and an award-winning novelist. Her sixth book, The New American, chronicles the journey of a young Guatemalan American college student who's deported from California to Guatemala and decides to make his way back home to Berkeley. And Micheline joins me in studio. Hi, thank you for coming in.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
Great to have you. We're also joined by Sara Campos, co-director and policy director of the New American Story Project. She's a writer and a lawyer and previously directed an asylum program at the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights and worked for the National Immigration Law Center. And Sara also joins us in studio. Thank you for joining us.
Yes, thank you for having me.
Great to have both of you. I'm so glad we're talking about this because when these families and these children fled to the United States, it got so much media coverage, but it's really died down since then. I mean, you really have to search for stories. So, Sara, I want to start off with you. Give us an update. What has happened since 2014 when so many people fled here? I mean, where are we today?
Well, the situation in Central America continues unabated. I should qualify that because things continue. There's gang recruitment, gang violence at horrendous levels. Although there's been some improvement. In 2015, the homicide rate was 105 per every 100,000 in the population, and it's gone down to 80. In the last year or so. So it's still bad. That's like four or five times what our, homicide rate in the United States is, which is about four per every 100,000. So the situation is still really horrendous in these countries, and children continue to come. Now, we've had, under the Obama administration, we had a whole campaign to tell people, don't come, it's too dangerous, and a number of policies against kids. And now we have a change in administration that's really gone overboard in terms of they really don't want these kids to come. In fact, they are pitting Dreamers, the DACA recipients, against unaccompanied immigrant kids. And I don't know if there was recent media coverage on the president sitting down with Charles Schumer and Nancy Pelosi and saying, we're going to, come up with an agreement on the Dreamers. And it looked like, well, this is all good, right? But the cost of that now is really high. It's not just a little more border security. It's like, let's change. We want a wall. We want tightened asylum procedures. We want tightened laws against these kids. So it's, the situation is pretty dire. And we have, children and women fleeing these countries and going to the border and being pushed back into Mexico and being told, you can't apply right now. You have to wait. People are in extreme danger.
Mm. I mean, the stories that you both tell are incredible. And the one thing that struck me about the reporting in 2014, we got a lot of numbers. And there was some good reporting about the horrific treatment of young people, especially who are coming here alone, which is so hard to comprehend. Mm-hmm. But I really appreciate that you tell the individual stories. And the young people that you both talk to live in Oakland. Micheline, I understand that when you were working on your sixth book, The New American, you had to do, obviously, a lot of research for this. You watched documentaries, you read magazine articles, and there were so many stories that really moved you. And that's why you decided to speak to young people and give them a voice, because you've got a lot of what you're doing is sort of short video interviews with different people, asking them why they left, what it was like to flee, mm-hmm. what it's like now that they're here. Just talk about that process.
Sure. When I finished a draft of The New American, as you said, when I was researching that book, because it's an unfolding story, the both Central Americans from Honduras and Guatemala and El Salvador fleeing, you know, northward through Mexico, fleeing terrible violence in their own countries and extraordinary rates of extortion and insecurity. I had to, like, look at YouTube and read newspaper articles in, you know, in those countries and try to find things here. But it was really difficult to find people's stories so that – and I really wanted – and for as a novelist, I'm continuously mining, like, what – you know, history is what happens to people. How do people experience it as it happens? This is a story that's happening now. And I felt frustrated that there was no – place, really, except for the journalism stories, which are important, but where people could tell their own stories. So when I finished a draft of that book, I took some of my grad students from Mills. I got a grant, and we went down into our local high school, Fremont High School in Oakland, to teach a creative writing class. And I thought, well, to accompany the novel, I'm going to support students who are newcomers to the United States to tell the story, their stories in their own words. To my shock, though, out of 29 students, 28 of them were recently arrived from Central America, from those three countries known as the, you know, the Northern Triangle, less than a year here. And the creative writing class was an absolute failure in the sense that the kids couldn't really write their stories. There were many reasons why, some of which were related to trauma. I mean, we started hearing stories from the teachers, I did, you know, that they were hearing from the kids. They were just extraordinarily terrible and horrific often. So out of the failure of that creative writing class came the New American Story Project. And Claire Calderon, who was a grad student of mine then and works with Sada and I now, said, let's tape the kids. Let's do an oral history project. I had never done anything like that. But I was like, well, let's do that. So she and I walked around that summer and just with her microphone and just sat down with kids. And what was amazing about that is the minute we sat down with the kids, when we had asked them to write their stories, they were like really formal and they were like maybe a paragraph long and they're like, things are good, you know, very simple. And then we sat down with a kid privately, because that was the other thing, is they are teenagers. They didn't want to share with their peers what they had gone through necessarily. And the first girl who was the first interview on that site, I think she's called Vilma there. We change all their names to protect their identities, not just here, because often here they have status, they have asylum, but at home we need to be careful. Gangs are also on social media. And she looked at us and the first thing she said was, they killed my father, mm-hmm. and I don't know why. And that was just the beginning of an epic journey. I mean, these kids who are here are really, they're heroic. I mean, they have made it. For every kid who's here, there are many, many others who have not and will not make it to safety and will not receive asylum. The unaccompanied children, I mean, they are seeking asylum, and we have laws which protect people who are in harm's way, who, if they remain in country, will likely either, you know, be killed or can't stay in their homes. I mean, the situation in those three countries remains terrible, and there are many complex reasons why they remain terrible. I know we like simple answers sometimes to complex situations, but the United States is very directly and indirectly involved in the situation today in those countries, as is Mexico. Mexico is a very dangerous place to be an undocumented Central American. They are terribly unprotected inside of Mexico as well and preyed upon by the gangs as they cross the country and the police. So.
Sada, can you talk about the legal rights that these children have? You previously directed an asylum program at the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights. What about the law? What does U.S. law say when it comes to young people seeking asylum here?
Well, they're like all people seeking asylum. Asylum is available for people who fear persecution in their own country and whose country they will not provide protection. So, but for children, there is a law called the Trafficking Victims Reauthorization Act, and this law was passed in 2008. It was unanimous in Congress and signed by President Bush, and it allows our country to treat children a little bit differently and seek the best interest of the children as it's providing protection. So when children arrive at the border and, you know, in the past, people used to come to the border and try to sneak in clandestinely. These children come and present themselves and say, here I am, I need help, you know, and they're put in detention. But there's a limitation on that detention. They can only be in detention for 72 hours. They're placed in the hands of Office of Refugee Resettlement. That part of the government finds a sponsor or family member who they can go to. And then they must apply for some form of legal relief, and it's usually asylum. Or another process called special immigrant and juvenile status. And one of the things that the Obama administration had done was provide for children who didn't meet the asylum prerequisites, they allowed them to parole in if they had a legal parent in the United States. This administration, the current administration, has completely disavowed that program. So, but generally people, you know, kids have to go to court and present their case. And one of the really terrible things about the way our system works is that there's no counsel provided. Mm-hmm. There's no lawyer. And the chances of getting asylum, if you don't have a lawyer, are dismal. You know, you're lost. It's a complex system. Each case is dependent on highly individual evidence. And if it's not there, if it's not articulated in quite the right way, kids are not going to make it.
In one of your videos, you spoke with Dana Leigh Marks, an immigration judge, and she said that if you take people who are detained and held, about 85% are held without an attorney to represent them. People who have lawyers are far more successful.
That's true. That's absolutely true. But not everyone, you know, a good 50% of the kids do not have counsel. You know, here in the Bay Area, we're fairly fortunate. We have a lot of nonprofits, you know, and a lot of generous people who give, you know, way more time than they have, you know, to make sure kids are protected. But in other places, that's not the case.
Sada Campos is co-director and policy director of the New American Story Project. Micheline Marcom is founder and creative director of the New American Story Project. And this project, you can find it on our website, yourcallradio.org. It documents the stories of children fleeing violence from El Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras. And these children are currently living in Oakland. And if you have any questions about these children, we'd love to hear from you. In 2014, authorities apprehended about 100,000 minors who were fleeing gang recruitment, physical and sexual violence, and poverty. These young people came to this country alone. I mean, it's really hard to wrap your head around that, but they fled their homes to come to the United States by themselves. And if you have any questions or comments about this, we'd love to hear from you. If you work with young immigrants in the Bay Area, we'd love to hear from you. What resources are available for them? What do they need? You can give us a call at 866-798-8255. How has your community responded to this crisis? And we're talking about kids from Central America, but what about kids from the Middle East? What about kids from Syria or Iraq or Yemen? if you have any stories about how your community is helping these kids, we'd love to hear from you. If you also work in the legal field, 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. You can tweet us at yourcallradio or leave a comment on our website. Let's talk a little bit about the basics, because, again, this is very difficult to comprehend. We'll talk about the stories, but as you both note in these, the children tell stories about fleeing physical and sexual violence, poverty, forced gang recruitment. What did they tell you about? Obviously, the situation got so bad that they fled their towns. They left their families to come here alone. Can you explain that? I mean, what did you hear from them? I mean, that's just an amazing, horrific decision to make for a 14-year-old or a 16-year-old.
Yeah, Micheline? Correct. And it's terrifying for them. As one of our subjects said to us from the very beginning, he said, look, nobody wants to leave their country, and I didn't want to leave mine. And it's, you know, but if your life is threatened, as it is, people don't go, like in El Salvador, we hear lots of stories about people, girls in particular, but boys too, not being able to really leave their homes. I mean, they go to school and they come home and that's it. And that's true in Honduras as well. People live inside their homes in certain neighborhoods. You know, let's say 65% of the people in these countries are poor. I think that's around the right statistic. That percentage of those populations are unprotected. They are not protected by their state. They are not protected by the police, which are generally, I think we can say, corrupted. The gangs control those neighborhoods. So you live a life of fear. Often with the kids that we've spoken to, something happens. Someone is murdered that they know very close to them. We interviewed a young man, for example, who was a Jehovah's Witness, a very devout young man, and they're required to go and proselytize, of course, as part of their, you know, belief. And he was threatened continuously. And when one of his cohort, one of his, you know, friends, buddies was murdered, he realized, I need to leave. Did he want to leave his parents and his siblings? No, of course not. And he left many siblings behind, but it was either stay and die, potentially, or try for the north and seek security. And, of course, they're not just heading north anymore. They're going all over the place. We also know that. I mean, Sada has followed it more than me, but I think statistically people are going wherever they can find safety. A lot of Central Americans are staying in Mexico, for example. I mean, it's a dire situation that pushes these kids out. And, you know, my family is from the Middle East, and I heard a lot about what was happening with Syria. And I've been to Syria, and I know people who were forced to leave. But these are children on our border. This is our refugee crisis, and we're talking such small numbers in a country of 340 million. Our country is enormous. It is not hard for us, under our current asylum laws, to provide safety for these children.
Especially since we've had a hand in creating some of these problems. You know, some of the gangs that are now, you know, proliferating or metastasized in El Salvador are gangs that were formed here in Los Angeles and exported out, you know. And it was, you know, in El Salvador and Guatemala as well. There have been civil wars that our government funded the wrong side. And when those wars ended, none of the issues that created those wars were solved. And these gangs were opportunistic. These were countries that had very corrupt systems, lots of violence, lots of arms, lots of people with nothing to do. So it's gotten to an untenable level. You know,
anytime we do shows about this issue, I always mention Juan Gonzalez, the co-host of Democracy Now. His documentary Harvest of Empire looks at specific countries in Central and South America and looks at U.S. foreign policy and all the issues you just mentioned, Sada. And then they interview people who have left their homes and they talk about, of course, why they don't want to leave, but they have to because of, for example, the U.S. supporting dictators, arming, providing arms, for example. Right. So you've got that, and then you have corrupt governments in these countries. And so these families and these kids are in a very difficult situation. And in many cases, the young children that you interviewed said that if they didn't join a gang, for example, the gang would go after their family. Or if a young girl who was harassed and raped said something, her mom's life would be at risk. This is very common, right?
Correct. That's what happens. The sexual violence in these countries is really, it's abysmal, you know, and that kind of retribution happens when, a family member doesn't want to provide, the money for extortion, then they threaten the children. Often it's the women and girls that are subject to sexual violence as a result.
And then they're subject to sexual violence on the journey out of their country to the United States, for example.
Right. Many of them take contraceptives in order, so as to not get pregnant.
Because they know that
this is such a high risk.
I think it's 80%. It's probably a lot higher, but the statistic is 80% of the girls and women who come north through Mexico are raped. And it is probably in the 90th percentile, but it's very hard to gather these statistics with accuracy. But just like I was reading, Honduras, for example, gender-based violence is the second leading cause of death for women of reproductive age. Women are not safe in these countries. And we've started by talking about children in our project, but we plan to also start talking about the women and the children because they're the other big part of this story. There's no protection. If you don't have a family member or somebody to protect you, you're very vulnerable.
What did you hear about the journey? Obviously, the sexual violence is pervasive, but just being on a bus, not knowing where you are being taken, and then when you get to point A, a gang might say, give us more money, or you're not going to go to point B. I mean, there's just so much that goes on along that journey. Can you share some of those stories?
Yes. I mean, in the past, I think children have ridden the beast, la bestia, that train that goes through Mexico, riding on the top, which is very dangerous, where it gets really cold on those steel rails and kids fall off and die, but they're also subject to extortion. The whole trip is fraught with smugglers, who demand money. Oscar Martinez, who's a journalist in El Salvador and who we profile in our website, has written about that journey, that train ride, and talks about how much corruption there is, and how there's just a whole economy around, exploiting the migrants that are coming through through Mexico. So it's a horrific journey.
Yeah, and once the drug cartels in Mexico got involved, as far as I understand it, and they took over in Mexico, then you kidnap people and you can, out of each person extort several thousand dollars. You take 80 people, whatever, and it's just a business, a very dangerous and ugly one. But, that's what's happened to migrants in Mexico. And there are a lot of very good people in Mexico. There are houses which provide shelter. Thank goodness. So there's some places of safety along the route. But
can you talk about more about Mexico? I was just thinking about people who are being deported from the United States to Mexico are also subject to all of this. I was reading, there's some really good investigative stories about how, for example, someone will be kidnapped and they will demand to know your family's name and information here in the U.S., right. And then they'll demand ransom. Or they'll beat you badly or kill you in the worst circumstance. So you've got that going on. And then you have people fleeing from Central America to Mexico. What happens in Mexico? Some of the people you interviewed said that when they got on buses, they were asked for IDs, and then they were taken and beaten. Can you talk about what happens when these kids get to Mexico?
Well, All I can say is it's a dangerous route, and it pretty much has to be done with a smuggler, and some of these kids attempt to do it on their own, but they're constantly subject to harassment and beaten and robbed, not to mention raped and defiled in other ways. I mean, there's this, I think the book The Beast, that Oscar Martinez wrote, there's a place, you know, where they document where, you know, there's it's really horrible even to describe, you know, this little area where there's some trees and there's panties hanging there, and this is a place where, you know, girls get raped. Mm. You know, it is it's a horrendous journey to have to do, and people almost can't do it without help.
Yeah. And we'll talk about what kind of assistance they actually get when they arrive in the United States. Sada Campos is co-director and policy director of the New American Story Project. Micheline Marcombe is founder and creative director of the New American Story Project. It's a collaboration of artists telling the stories of immigrants and refugees in order to bear witness, raise awareness, and provoke conversation. And you can see some of the interviews that they did with young people who have fled violence in El Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras. These young people are now living in Oakland, and you can find links at yourcallradio.org. This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Today, we are talking about children who have fled brutal violence in El Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras. Since 2014, U.S. authorities have apprehended nearly 100,000 unaccompanied minors fleeing things like gang recruitment, physical and sexual violence, and poverty. And this got a lot of attention in 2014 and 2015. We haven't seen that many stories about this. So today we're talking about the status of these children. What is the situation like today? What kind of support are they getting once they arrive in the United States? And we're speaking with Micheline Marcombe, founder and creative director of the New American Story Project. Her sixth book, The New American, chronicles the journey of a young Guatemalan American college student who's deported from California to Guatemala and then decides to make his way back home to Berkeley. We're also joined by Sada Campos, co-director and policy director of the New American Story Project. It's a collaboration of artists telling the stories of immigrants and refugees in order to bear witness and raise awareness. Sada is also, she used to direct the asylum program at the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights. And if you have any questions or comments about young people who flee El Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras for the United States, we'd love to hear from you. If you work with these young people, we'd love to hear from you. And if you've seen people in your community respond to this crisis and you have a story to share, give us a call at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@KALW, leave a comment on our website, or you can tweet us at yourcallradio. Let's talk about what happens when these children arrive in the United States and they are met by ICE. I know all the stories differ, but what really stood out to you when you interviewed these young people? Sada?
Well, you know, what stood out for me, and I think what stood out for the kids, is ICE, you know, in general. I mean, the hieleras is what they call them, the ICE boxes. They're held in detention in these places that are extremely cold. And in 2014, we saw all kinds of footage of, you know, kids huddled together, you know, in these really overcrowded situations in these detention facilities at the border. That's what, you know, that they all call them, the hieleras, the ice boxes. And they, by law, they can only stay there for 72 hours before the Office of Refugee Resettlement can take control, and they can find sponsors or other family members in the United States to care for them. But they quickly need to find a lawyer after that. And as we've talked about, lawyers aren't free, you know, unless they can hit upon a nonprofit organization. Mm-hmm. They need counsel in order to assemble a case and talk about why they were here, why they're here, and get some protection.
Yeah, I mean, all the kids mentioned La Hielera, the freezer, the icebox, because imagine you're 13 years old, you're 14 years old, and you've arrived to the country that in your mind is looms large as this beacon of a place of hope where you can be safe, where you can have a life so unlike the one that you've had. You know, I mean, America is that place, remains in people's imagination a place of hope. So you come here, and then you're put in La Hielera, the freezer, and that's just, I mean, you know, disorienting to say the least. But then there are the kids, you know, they're often sent to these casa hogares, these homes, and they really speak, in my experience, that they're well taken care of. And they're, you know, given clothes, and they're given food, and they're given shelter, and then a sponsor is found for them. So overall, I haven't heard terrible stories, but SADA has done a lot more work with families in detention than I have. But it's just the moment of just, you know, to arrive here, just to put yourself in a child's shoes, alone by herself or himself, in this country. It's so scary.
It's so scary. You tell the story of Jose Luis, a 16 from Honduras. He said that he's gay, he's been sexually abused, he drank to forget everything, he tried to commit suicide. And then he said that during the journey, as we were talking about, various people would pick him up, he'd be in vans, he had to pay extra money. He talked about dealing with hunger, thirst, cold, and then heat. This was really awful to learn about, that smugglers give these children drugs to keep them awake and to keep walking. The other thing he said is that everybody in the van is united. So if they have one apple, they will share it among everyone because they want everyone to make it. How did Jose Luis end up in Oakland? What's that journey like? Do you remember? Or if not his story, how do these kids?
I mean, once they've surrendered to at the border, saying I need help, you know, they're put. I think they have those 3 days in the jail, and then they're sent to a home, and then a sponsor. And often they have a relative in the United States, mm-hmm. a brother, or a sister, an aunt, an uncle, with whom they are reunited. That's the best case scenario. So for most of the kids, the nightmare. That extreme nightmare ends for them if the kids that we've interviewed, because they have asylum, and the beginning of a legal process, a long one. We work with Centro Legal de la Raza in Oakland, an extraordinary group of attorneys who provide representation, and that's how we found these children. And they're safe now. I mean, it's a transition, obviously, a huge transition to life in the United States. But as I said before, they're the lucky ones, you know, and they know it. They're just so grateful. I mean, these kids are so grateful. When they see their attorneys, they always just, you know, hug them. They save their lives.
Their families and their parents are still in Central America?
Some of them. Some of them reunite with a parent that they haven't seen in, you know, decades, you know.
Wow.
Some of them reunite with uncles, aunts, you know, friends of family. One kid, I think... You know, one of the kids that's profiled in our website got reunited with an older brother. You know, and he had memorized the telephone number of his brother. And when he called his brother wasn't quite sure it was him. He says, "Is this really who I think it is? Who, you know, are you really you?
Yeah.
You know,
it was the boy you mentioned at the beginning, because he couldn't tell anyone he was leaving Guatemala. Mm. It's not safe to tell." Excuse me, your family, you're leaving. You have to leave without saying anything. So he didn't tell his brother in the United States, and he didn't tell his parents at home. He just left.
Well, you can watch these stories at yourcallradio.org. There are videos from the new American Story Project. And if you'd like to join us, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@KALW, tweet us at yourcallradio, or leave a comment on our website. Let's hear from Jamie in San Francisco. Hi, Jamie. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Rose. Thanks for taking my call. I live in Western Soma, where Honduran young, very young men are recruited, obviously, into a Honduran drug gang that exists here in the Bay Area. I'm pretty sure they're based in Oakland, and they're selling crack on the streets of Western Soma. And the local police are pretty aware that they're Honduran, and they seem to know about them, because I go to the It's Captain Fong in the Western Soma area that covers this in Southern Station. And I mentioned that, you know, there's activity on a regular basis. And these men are very, very young. I mean, they could easily be in high school. And they're recruited into these drug dealing gangs. So I wondered if there's any work to sort of investigate the fate of teenage and even slightly older young people who come to this country and then get caught up in forced labor in the drug gangs here.
I don't know too much about that, about who might be working with them. I know a local organization, Caresen, works with young kids who've had trouble with the law, and does work with immigrants as well. I mean, they might be somebody to contact about this situation, about the issue, to extend themselves to them. I don't know too much more.
Yeah, I don't either. I mean, the kids that we've been talking to, we keep track of them with Centro, and, you know, they're in school, and they're working. I mean, those kids have, all of them work almost immediately. They have to make money while they're here, even when they're in school. So a lot of the kids we interview go to school 8:30 to 3, and then they go to their jobs from 4 to 10 at night. That's most of the kids that I've spoken to. And they're dishwashing, and they're washing cars, and they're cleaning houses. Those are the kids that we've spoken to.
What kind of support do they have? Financial, but also to deal with the trauma that they've endured. Not much.
I mean, yeah. Social service, you know, or whatever they get from high school, you know, the counselors.
Oakland Unified has been very supportive of the kids. We work with Patricia Segura, who runs the newcomer program at Fremont High School, and she herself and her staff and other people in the district have done their best to support the kids. And that's come from outside support as well, from Alameda County, I think. So, you know.
And I think Instituto Familiar de la Raza, locally as well, they have a mental health service. I recall that they did, you know, some group work with some of these kids. You know, but there aren't enough resources, right?
And I was just thinking that since the deportations have increased so drastically, so many of these organizations are in need of financial contributions. I mean, so many people are stretched so thin right now. Well, thank you for calling in, Jamie. We have an email from a listener who says, my son's family is in El Salvador, and we've sent them remittances. Money for many years. They live in an adobe in the country. No indoor plumbing, electricity, and potable water just arrived recently. The mother sells fruit. The father cuts cane for about $10 a day. The gangs are everywhere. When they showed up in their home, they put a gun to my godson's head. The teenage boy in the house next door was shot. Half the family fled to Guatemala, the other half to the capital. My godson doesn't leave the house now. We are terrified that the gangs will track us here. No one who hasn't experienced this can comprehend that level of fear. We want to help my godson, but there are no good options. I'm even afraid of writing this message.
Mm. Yeah. You know, one thing we haven't spoken about is we have interviewed a lot of children, but we realized very quickly that the children could talk about how terrifying it was for them in their countries, but they couldn't contextualize. They couldn't say what was going on. They didn't know. I mean, you're 10, you're 11, you're 12, you're 5, you're 14, and, you know, your life is chaotic. And so we've interviewed 22 historians, academics, journalists, anthropologists. In fact, Jason De Leon just won a MacArthur Genius Grant. He's one of the people we've interviewed. He did a beautiful book on migrants and the migrant trail. But, you know, even the people the anthropologists I've spoken to who work in Honduras and El Salvador, they are traumatized as well. I mean, someone we spoke to said he estimated that 85% of the population or more of the whole population of El Salvador, this is a tiny country of 6 million people, is walking around with post-traumatic stress syndrome. People are terrified. So, you know, a little bit of compassion would go such a long way to just put yourself in someone else's shoes. I mean, what makes a child leave his home? You know, no one wants to. And I don't understand in what's happening in this country these days that people are being so closed-hearted. I think it's mostly just misinformation and manipulation. Politicians always manipulate immigration issues. We know this historically, but these are children, for goodness sake. And that email is, I mean, that's so moving. People don't know what to do. Where can they go? You know, they have nowhere to turn.
And I'm sure there are other families like this listener who's struggling to figure out how to help or to what they can do.
And if they know you're sending money, they'll go after you.
Wow. Well, do you have any recommendations, Sada? I mean, have you heard from other families that are in this situation?
I think what Micheline is saying and what the family said, I mean, this is petrifying fear, like what, you know, and it's kind of like when you get really cold, you can't get rid of it, right? It's just, it's pervasive. It's ubiquitous. And that's what it's like in these countries.
Well, thank you for writing in, and I wish we had something to share.
I think what we can do in our country is support humane immigration policies. We have laws which protect children and women and children and men. The men are, it's like, let's have humane dialogue and deep, and immigration laws which are fair and a system which works well. I think that's what everybody wants. No one's asking for a free ride.
Well, sadly, here we are today. Donald Trump started his campaign by saying that Mexicans are rapists. I mean, it's coming right from the top, which is bringing out so many people who are overtly racist. So, I mean, it was hard enough to do this under Obama. I mean, he was called the deporter in chief, right? And people said we need a humane policy under Barack Obama. And here we are.
Well, that's the problem with the fact that President Obama had the policies that he had, that he did become the deporter in chief, and so that becomes like the standard that needs to go even further under this administration, who wants to, really put a stake down on immigration, and not in a good way. I mean, they want to dismantle the Trafficking Victims Protection Act for kids. They want to just send them back. Back to put them in harm's way. They want to go after families who directly or indirectly engaged a smuggler to get their kids back to the United States. They want to go after children who said that they were unaccompanied, and once they have a sponsor or a guardian, they deem them not accompanied anymore. And so they want to put them back into deportation proceedings and send them back. So they want to completely dismantle, the protections that we have available right now, as slim as they are.
We talked earlier about how horrific the situation is in Mexico, although so many people there are trying to help. But with the election of Donald Trump, migrants fleeing Central America are seeking asylum in Mexico instead of coming to the U.S. According to The Economist, in 2016, there were 9,000 asylum seekers. In the first half of this year, there have already been 7,000 in Mexico.
And people aren't coming to our border very much. They got the message. I think we've been at net zero immigration from Mexico for some time, I think, as far as I understand it, and our numbers are very low. So, when people talk about building a wall and all of this rhetoric, you have to wonder what's really going on. And as someone said to us who we interviewed, look up, follow the money. Mm. This is about money. This has nothing. We don't need a wall. We have so much. The border is so militarized. Nobody gets through. And if you want to get through on your own, you have to walk across one of the most inhospitable places on earth for humans, the Sonoran Desert, for 4 or 5 days, where the temperature reaches 120 degrees and your chances of surviving are slim. So the only people who talk about building a wall are people who don't live on the southern border or know it very well. It's money. There's money. And then just the typical easy way to manipulate people with, demonizing an other. Oh, well, who's easy to demonize? The immigrant, the person who can't speak up, who's terrified, who doesn't have documents. This is sick.
Let's hear from Stephen in San Francisco. Hi, Stephen. Welcome to the show.
Hi. I'm really enjoying listening to you guys. I'm a teacher at City College of San Francisco, and I'm actually have been interviewing a lot of young Central Americans for a book with Voice of Witness. In fact, I've met your two guests,
Hi,
the director,
Steven.
Mimi Locke. Hi, how are you?
Good.
I'm really enjoying listening to you. I, sort of actually just driving to teach today and sort of was lucky to hear the program and have heard the majority of it. I wanted to share a story about one of my students who I was speaking to recently. He's a native from Guatemala. His parents were both survivors of the Guatemalan, what's commonly called the Civil War, a war that the U.S. is very complicit with. He fled Guatemala without knowledge of English or Spanish and has an amazing story of arriving at the border and sort of navigating across the border without languages. He's been here for about 15 years. He heroically kind of split up with his father in order to pursue education because his father was very sort of against education and thought men should work manually. He's about to transfer from City College to a university. He's a father figure for his younger siblings who have arrived, a few of them, and he's successfully helped them apply for asylum. All the while, he's a DACA recipient, and he's just found out that, you know, DACA is going to be canceled, and he doesn't know what to do. You know, he's sort of, you know, next year he's either going to, pursue his dreams or he's going to be deported back to Guatemala where he has no idea what he's going to do. And I just wanted to share that story as well in context of the conversation about our current administration.
Thank you for that story. We did a show about DACA recipients a couple of weeks ago. Is there any new news on that?
Not that I'm aware.
No, everyone's in limbo. I mean, just dealing with the uncertainty is traumatic.
Well, I think
for
it's
so many
what
people.
Sada said, pitting children against children. So DACA right. against asylum seekers, I mean, you know.
Well, it's DACA against asylum seekers and a whole plan of, like, let's completely dismantle what we have right now. You know, let's create an immigration system that's based on merit. No to sanctuary cities. We have to have a wall. All of these things in exchange for, you know, providing protection for 800,000 people in this country of 340 million people.
Mm-hmm. You spoke with young people who received asylum, but is it true that the majority of the young people fleeing violence do not receive asylum in the U.S.?
I don't think that's true. I think the system is set up to provide nonprofit lawyers who can assist children. And I think this is a priority for nonprofit organizations that do immigration services. So I'm not sure that that's true.
Okay.
No, it's if you do not have representation in court, we've heard a story from Paul Chavez before he started working for Centro Legal where he saw, I think it was a boy who was 4 or 5 years old representing himself in court. That child very unlikely to win his case. He might have a very strong case for seeking asylum in this country. So it's representation that is the key. Children with representation are very likely to win their cases. They have strong cases. But without representation, which is not provided through – immigration is not criminal court. Most people don't realize that. Immigration is civil law.
Right.
So a very big difference. People should – I've learned so much. I'm a novelist. This is not my terrain. I've just learned all of this as we go because I think these stories matter and the kids matter. And
have we seen any changes in El Salvador, Guatemala, or Honduras since this all started? In terms of government response, or is it the same?
Well, each country's a little different,
yeah.
Right? And in both Guatemala and Honduras, there is talk of a Central American spring. I mean, there's a lot of movement happening at the moment. A lot of demonstration against corruption and the like. In El Salvador, the numbers have come down in terms of the extreme homicide rates of 2015. But I don't see much change, in terms of government and the way that they're treating the issue of gangs and gang violence.
We have a couple minutes left, and I'd like to ask both of you what changes you'd like to see. You talk about a humane immigration policy. Can you be specific about the kinds of changes you would like to see that would actually help these children?
Well, actually, if we stuck to, you know, to enforcing the laws that we have, that would be good. If we had actual counsel for these children as a matter of law, that would be a real step in the right direction.
Yeah, I think that's right. It's honoring the laws that we have on our books since, you know, Second World War, and then this anti-trafficking law for children, and representation. Kids need representation. But more than that, I just, you know, people opening their hearts, if try to just, you know, go a little deeper than the sound bites. Politicians lie all the time. We all know this. Mm. So what's really going on here?
And the media has a role in all of this.
Yeah.
Huge role.
Keeps repeating lies all the time about immigration. Immigrants, every study of merit that I have ever read says the same thing. When an immigrant community comes into your community, it benefits the community.
We don't have time to take Bill in San Francisco, but he says the U.S. creates so many of these problems and then they use the people as the pawns.
That's right.
And next, you're going to give a voice to women?
Women and children.
Women and children.
Because they're not protected by that anti-trafficking law, so they are jailed. They're detained. Often for years now.
Well, we'd love to do a show about that.
For-profit prison.
Right, and talk about the conditions. Micheline Marcomb is founder and creative director of the New American Story Project. Her sixth novel, The New American, chronicles the journey of a young Guatemalan-American college student who's deported from California to Guatemala and then decides to make his way back home to Berkeley. Sara Campos is co-director and policy director of the New American Story Project. It's a collaboration of artists telling the stories of immigrants and refugees in order to bear witness, raise awareness, and provoke conversation. And I hope you can go to our website, yourcallradio.org, and then see some of these videos, interviews with young people who have fled El Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras on their own, and they are now living in Oakland. Sara and Micheline, thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you so much.
Your Call is produced here at KALW in San Francisco. To listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. You can also find us on iTunes, where you can give us a review. Follow us on Twitter at Your Call Radio. Email show ideas and feedback to yourcall@kalw.org. Laura Flynn produced today's show. Lauren Schechter is our intern. Kevin Vance is our studio engineer. Thanks for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.